It's Sunday, August 8th, and this is For Good Reason.
Welcome to For Good Reason. I'm DJ Grothy. For Good Reason is the radio show and podcast produced in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation, an international nonprofit whose mission is to advance critical thinking about the paranormal, pseudoscience, and the supernatural. I'm happy that my guest this week is the Reverend Michael Dowd. Along with his wife, science writer Connie Barlow, he has lived permanently on the road for many years, sharing what he calls the sacred view of evolution with both religious and secular audiences alike. One of his books we'll be talking a bit about today is Thank God for Evolution, How the Marriage of Science and Religion Will Transform Your Life and Our World. Welcome to For Good Reason, Michael Dowd.
Great to be here, DJ.
Michael, you're a man of the cloth, as they say, or, you know, you have this religious history yourself. You've formerly pastored a number of churches. You might be considered a religious defender of evolution. But most people imagine religion and evolution to be at war. Tell me why you use one to actually fight for or in defense of the other.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure it would be accurate to say that I religiously defend evolution, because basically I think all religions have been maps of reality, mythic maps of reality. That is, they've been maps of what's real and what's important. That if you follow your, you know, if you use that map of reality to guide your life, you'll experience personal wholeness and social coherence. This is, you know, a basic understanding of the nature of religion. I think Loyal Rue has articulated it best. And our best understanding today of the nature of reality doesn't come from tradition. It doesn't come from scripture. It doesn't come from any authority in the past. It comes from science. It comes from evidence. And so I'm a defender, if you will, of our best evidential understanding. In fact, defender isn't the right word. I am a proponent. I'm an evangelist. Of our best evidential understanding of the nature of reality, our best collective intelligence around physical evolution, biological evolution, and cultural evolution, big history, in other words. Mm-hmm. And I do it in, I share it, my wife and I both share this perspective, this ethic of evolution, in religiously nourishing ways, that is in ways that nourish people emotionally, that call them to greater integrity, greater compassion, greater love, greater generosity, and so forth.
But you're getting all of that oomph of that kind of sermon, right, from the story of evolution, not from traditional religious narratives. You're instead talking about what scientists talk about when they talk about the origins of life, and you're deriving almost religious meaning out of it.
Yeah, exactly. It was certainly religious feelings. One of the things that we know about human consciousness, human nature, the nature of our brains, is that we're interpreters. That's what human animals do. We interpret. And so that we see as a sacred calling, if you will. In other words, for individuals and groups to thrive, we have to interpret reality. Now, of course, our best understanding of reality today comes through evidence. It comes through historical evidence, scientific evidence, cross-cultural experience. It doesn't come from tradition. It doesn't come from scripture. And yet, that task of interpreting has largely been left to people in the human religions. And I think that's one of the reasons why I'm grateful that Sam Harris is doing what he's doing lately, is that we need to build an ethical, moral understanding, a sense of values, what's most important to us, based on our best evidential understanding, not based on ancient maps of reality.
So how is what you do, as you evangelize, you used the word, travel the country, speak in churches about evolution, about how important buying into evolution is, how is that different than, say, mainline Protestants who also buy into the theory of evolution and say that it is not incompatible with their traditional views of of their doctrines, you know, the salvific power of Jesus Christ or sin or, you know, God creating everything, all that stuff?
Well, it's a huge difference because it's an accommodationism of a different sort. I think what you just described that most Protestants do is they try to, that basically the tradition is accommodating to the evidence, but Connie and I are going about it in a radically opposite way. We're basically saying that religions, for religions, any religion in the world to survive into the future, it's going to have to evolve, and it's going to have to basically evolve in step with evidence, in step with our best science. And one of the things that we get from that is a recognition that all ancient religious concepts and dogma and doctrines and theologies are mythic. They're night language. That is, they may speak to the heart and touch people's emotions and motivate people, but they do so in the way that dreams do. They're mythic, and if we interpret them literally, it belittles the tradition. So what I'm trying to do in my work and my ministry is to help religious people to wholeheartedly embrace an evidential understanding and lift it up at least equal, if not higher, than tradition and scripture, because we have to be guided as a species by our best evidential understanding of reality in order for us to have a clear sense of what's important.
Before we get into this agenda of yours to naturalize or kind of de-supernaturalize religion, and I think that's what you're about, I just want to ask you point blank, are you religious, or is it just that you're religious in a metaphorical sense, but you don't actually believe in a deity and all that?
Well, the way you phrase the question sort of loads it, and I would say, no, I'm not religious in the way that you just characterized, and yes, I am religious in the way that religious naturalists use the term. Mm. I have no otherworldly beliefs. I have no supernatural beliefs. I don't hold anything supernatural or otherworldly or mythic or superstitious at all, nothing. My entire worldview is grounded in our best evidential understanding of reality. And yet, for me, religion, religio, it's about reconnecting to reality. And so no, I don't see religion as supernatural otherworldlyism. Mm. I see religion, I follow very, very clearly an understanding of religion that Loyal Rue, I think, articulates best in his book, Religion is Not About God. But also in his little short volume, Everybody's Story, which is that all religions are mythic maps of how things are and which things matter. Hmm. That if you align your life by that map of how things are and which things matter, or what's real and what's important, you'll experience personal wholeness and social coherence. There's not a religion anywhere in the world that isn't a mythic map of how things are and which things matter that produce personal wholeness and social coherence. Except that today, because many people are still operating out of 2,000 or 3,000-year-old maps of reality, we're actually making some real mistakes with regards to what's important, because we're operating out of a map of what's real that's totally outdated. It's kind of like trying to drive. I mean, I'm talking to you from Florida. It's like trying to drive from Florida to Portland, Oregon, when you had a GPS that hasn't been reprogrammed since 1840. Mm. I mean, you know, it's got the Oregon Trail. I mean, you're not going to get there. And many people, many religious people, millions and millions of religious people are trying to guide their lives, which affects how they vote, affects, you know, the public policy that they want to put in place, affects a whole bunch of things. And they're operating out of 2,000 or 3,000-year-old mass of reality. And I think that we have got to find ways of bringing religious people out of a mythic mindset and into an evidential mindset.
Michael, I can wrap my head around what you're saying and get into it. It's something I can endorse. If what you're saying, if I'm not misunderstanding, you're basically saying, look, science gives us the best story of the way things are and what matters. Religion is an attempt at that, but its maps are outdated. So let's update religion and bring it more in line with science. You're talking basically about denuding or gutting traditional religion and bringing it up to science's standards, right?
Kind of. I see it more as the evolution of religion. And it's not even the evolution of religion. It's the evolution of humanity's meaning-making systems. Mm. Human systems, human groups have always needed meaning-making systems. That is, some way of interpreting reality that has promoted cooperation, generosity, care, consideration, all the sort of pro-social emotions and behaviors. I mean, the pro-social emotions emerge from our social nature. But our pro-social behaviors come out of an interpretive system. And yes, if we continue to try to guide, especially societies, by ancient maps of what's real and what's important, especially in a world where weapons of mass destruction are getting ever smaller and smarter and easier to obtain, we're in deep, deep trouble as a species. So, no, I'm not trying to gut or denude religion. All of us working in this realm are trying to help the religions evolve and become naturalized or realized, R-E-A-L, that has become measurably connected to measurable reality, not just sort of this mythic, supernatural, superstitious realm.
Well, by gut, I mean you're trying to denude it of the supernaturalism, of that mumbo-jumbo.
Yeah, but I mean, see, this is the thing that a lot of people don't get, DJ, is that supernaturalism is a pretty recent phenomenon. I mean, Benson Salem in 1977 wrote a major paper where he showed that the type of it was supernatural as a Western category. And until we began having an understanding of natural in a science-based way, there wasn't the need to distinguish the supernatural. It was only when we began to understand things in a natural, measurable, science-based way that it was deemed necessary by some to speak of a supernatural realm, that which was beyond or above nature. Prior to that, people used a blend of day and night experience, day and night language. So they would speak about things, you know, creatures flying and gods and goddesses talking and all this kind of mythic kind of stuff, that if you interpret it literally, it'd be supernatural. But, you know, when you fly in your dreams, it's not supernatural. Mm-hmm. That's just what happens in the dream state. And people used a blend of daytime and nighttime language and metaphors prior to the scientific understanding of reality as a basis of their understanding and their meaning-making. But to interpret that as supernatural is, I think, missing the point. It's giving too much to the religious people in a conservative sense.
Mm. But you're not saying that before the scientific revolutions of the 17th and 18th centuries that there weren't kind of worldviews steeped in supernaturalism. Even if they didn't bifurcate reality between the natural and the supernatural, you're not denying that people believed in a bunch of stuff that wasn't real. You know, people believed in ghosts and goblins and gods and, you know, creatures that flew. And they weren't only thinking of them in terms of their dreams. They thought they were real, right?
I don't know that that's the case. I don't know that the evidence supports that. Certainly, yes, they had a multi-storied understanding of the universe. I mean, even what we call the universe. You know, they had a multi-storied understanding of reality and used a blend of day and night metaphors to talk about that. But did they actually believe that spirits flew, or was that the best that language could capture in terms of this, you know, exaltation of feeling that they had? I don't know. Mm. People make the case on both sides of it, but I don't think that's as important as recognizing that today we recognize that we live in a universe, one reality, and that we don't live in a two-story or three-story universe. And yes, a lot of religious people still use that kind of supernatural-sounding language, and I think that will ultimately die out. I mean, we're seeing, even here in America, we're seeing that the idea that America is so religious as opposed to Europe doesn't hold as much water. I mean, about 20% of Americans actually go to church. It's just that we lie about it because it's tied up in our identity. We have to be perceived as religious, or we have to think of ourselves as religious, because otherwise, you know, our eternal soul is at stake for many religious people. Hmm. But what Connie and I are trying to do is basically awaken religious people to the fact that they can get these primary feeling states that humans have always needed to thrive, such as trust when you look to the future rather than fear, or gratitude when you look at the past rather than resentment or guilt, or inspiration in the moment to be in action no matter what the challenges of the day are. People can get those feeling states now from an evidential understanding of reality. They don't have to go to a mythic understanding, but they can do so also in a way that helps the religious traditions become naturalized or realized, or, you know, that helps them to evolve.
Okay, Michael, so it sounds to me like you've had Maybe you'll bristle at this, but you've had a kind of deconversion experience, so you no longer feel steeped in that supernaturalism that traditional religion hawks out there. You pastored a number of churches, and earlier on you were kind of traditionally religious, and now you're what you are, kind of a naturalized religious person. So you've deconverted in that sense. But on the other hand, you haven't wanted to go so far as to give up the language of religion, even if you've given up some of those supernatural beliefs. I think a lot of liberal religious folks are like that. Folks like Bishop John Shelby Spong, he doesn't believe in the virgin birth, sin, heaven, hell, any of that stuff, but he still loves the church. He still speaks the language of his faith tradition. So here's the question. Why don't you do what so many other people who by science, hook, line, and sinker, and just throw out the religious language at the same time you throw out the religious beliefs?
Well, first of all, I don't need any of the religious language. I don't use any religious language traditionally or in any kind of a way for myself.
But you talk about evolution saving us in much the same way that traditional Jesus believers talk about Jesus Christ saving us.
I do not. Where do we say anything like that?
In conversations we've had and in this great book, Thank God for Evolution, you talk about evolution and kind of an evolutionary worldview being the only way that we're going to basically solve all the problems facing us.
Yeah, whatever I said in the past that allowed you to interpret or led you to interpret it that way, let me clarify, because that's not what I'm saying at all. What I would argue is that if we don't have an accurate sense of how things really are, we're not going to be operating out of a sense of which things really matter that's going to do it. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, yes, I do fully embrace a deep time understanding of reality. That is a 14 billion year history of physical, biological, and cultural evolution that we're an expression of, that we're part of that. And so, yes, my sense of identity is I am the universe. We're all an expression of this universe. We're a result of billions of years of creativity. I'm related to everything. We're all related to everything. So in that sense, I do think that an evolutionary understanding of reality is our best understanding of how things are. But I don't think it saves us in any way. I do think that when we have an evolutionary understanding of our nature, for example, what drives us, why we shoot ourselves in the foot, why we say we're going to do something and we don't, why we're tempted in certain ways, why, you know, all the kinds of things that people struggle with that religions have traditionally given sort of mythic answers to, we now have evidential understandings. And that's why I do think that an understanding of human nature from an evolutionary standpoint does give us freedom that in traditional circles gets talked about like salvation, but I don't use that kind of language when I'm in a normal conversation with normal people. I would say this, that if you want a kick-ass life, if you want a great life and thriving relationships and a peaceful death and a sweet legacy, beliefs have got nothing to do with it.
Mm.
And that's what I'm trying to do, is I'm trying to invite people to have, you know, a deeply meaningful, thriving life and relationships, you know, high quality of life, a peaceful death and a sweet legacy. And do so by recognizing that science can provide that. And traditional language of inspiration and joy and integrity, I use that kind of language, but I don't use any supernatural language.
Hmm. You seem to be straddling the fence kind of between the religious community and the skeptical community, or maybe straddling the fence isn't the right way to say it. You're in both worlds, even when they don't overlap. So you've spoken at conservative churches, traditional churches, you've spoken at liberal churches, you've spoken to skeptical groups. And sometimes, yes, there's an overlap. Where are you most at home at in looking at all the audiences you speak at? Where do you and your wife, Connie Barlow, where do you guys find yourselves fitting best?
People like you. Most humanists and atheists and secular people, non-religious people. The people that are our closest tribe would be the people like Loyal Rue, Ursula Goodenough, mm-hmm. the religious naturalists. I sometimes call myself a mythic naturalist. But, you know, and again, religion not meaning anything otherworldly, but those of us who are coming solely, purely from an evidential science-based perspective, and yet we relish in our religious feelings, that is, feelings of joy, exaltation, passion, enthusiasm, generosity, all that kind of stuff that often gets associated with religion, that in many secular humanist groups, it's a little more cerebral. So there's a part of me that still enjoys the dance and the celebration and the, you know, when I'm in an awesome, like I was in the Grand Canyon last year, you know, many times you would find me with my arms outstretched to the sky, not because I believe there's anyone up there out there, but because that feeling state, when your body is in that kind of position, it's an exalted feeling. Mm.
I know a lot of skeptics who can feel that kind of exalted feeling. Now, I know curmudgeonly sourpuss types, too, who just turned their nose at any of that. But, you know, there are skeptics and seculars who they don't so much identify with the new atheists. They're not religious. They don't go to church. But they have this kind of, oh, cosmic sensibility. You know, like the kind of feeling you get after you watch Carl Sagan's Cosmos, right? It isn't so much that these people are religious, nor are they hardline atheists. They just have a broader agenda than just sticking it to God belief. If you were going to evangelize for evolution, and you want to kind of cast as wide a net as possible, you know, that's what evangelism is, right? To kind of get the good news, the gospel of evolution out there. Would the message that you are preaching, so to speak, would it be different to those folks than if you spoke at a church on the one hand, or if you spoke to some hardline new atheist group on the other?
Not really. Actually, in the last 9 years that Connie and I have traveled North America, we've spoken to about 1,200 different groups.
Wow.
And there's three major populations, three very distinct and radically different populations that we've spoken in many dozens, hundreds of times, actually. One is Christians, Catholic and Protestant Christians. We speak, you know, I've spoken 400 or 500 times in Catholic and Protestant Christian churches and monasteries and convents and, you know, retreat houses and what have you. The second group of people that we speak to a lot are secularists, humanists, atheists, science groups, environmental groups, non-religious groups who are usually already grounded in science, grounded in evidence. And a deep commitment to the planet, but they're not religious. And we speak all the time to groups like that. I mean, I spoke recently, Michael Shermer had me at Caltech, did the distinguished lecture there, and had, you know, 350 humanists and atheists. They loved my program. But the third group, which is very distinct and radically different than those two, are the sort of new thought, new age, integral, you know, everybody from Ken Wilber and integral philosophy to sort of the more woo-woo kind of folks. And those people also love what Tom and I are offering. Now, those three populations, Christians, secular folks, and New Thought, New Age, they don't really understand or respect each other, and yet all of them are just like totally eating up this evidential gospel, this evidential understanding of good news that Connie and I promote. And I think the reason, and in fact, on my website, on the Great Story website, which is our main education website, thegreatstory.org, the main program that I now deliver in all religious and non-religious and even anti-religious settings is called Evolutionize Your Life. And it's right at the top left, big yellow color. You can't possibly miss it if you go to the Great Story website, Evolutionize Your Life. And you'll see I deliver that exact same program in religious groups, to religious groups of all different kinds, as well as to non-religious and even anti-religious groups.
It has a kind of universal appeal, whether you're talking to the Ken Wilber, California Institute of Integral Studies type people, or the fundamental, well, I guess not fundamentalists so much as just kind of Christian, Protestant and Catholics, right? They're not literalists necessarily. Or the atheist, your message has a universal kind of a broad appeal, even if those groups aren't talking to themselves. Do you think that's because your sermon, your message, the gospel you preach is really about nourishment from the story of evolution. It, you know, the story actually gives, I think, traditional religion a run for its money, because you're not saying live the good life by getting closer to God, by reading scripture, believing it literally, you know, doing 20 Hail Marys or self-flagellating or, you know, whatever. Those are extreme examples, but you get what I'm saying. The way to the good life is by knowing our real place in the universe and being nourished by that story. So last question, isn't that more of a threat to traditional religion than, you know, just somebody decrying traditional religion for being nonsense? You know, skeptics who doubt the significance in the modern world of traditional religion, you know, what you call kind of night language or the fundamentalism where it's faith claims and all that. That seems less of a challenge than people like you who want to transform religion from the inside and take the supernatural out of it, naturalize it, but not get rid of any of the meaning or the importance of it.
Kind of. I mean, for example, not long ago, I interviewed 38 of the world's leading theologians and Christian scientists, including a couple Nobel laureates, and, you know, it's called evolutionarychristianity.com.
And to clarify, you mean scientists who are Christian, not Mary Baker Eddy Christian scientists.
Exactly, scientists that are Christian. but all of them are coming, I mean, just all, the whole gamut, from liberals to conservative, Catholic, Protestants, all over the map, who fully embrace an evidential deep-time understanding of reality and have a global heart, that is a commitment to the health and the well-being of the planet as a whole. And yes, I am considered a threat by the fundamentalists. I mean, the president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, Al Mohler, and I had a public debate, and my response to him, which you can find easily online, is called Biblical Christianity is Bankrupt. Mm. And so you can see how I speak to fundamentalists and conservatives in that way. And yes, I'm considered a profound threat. I mean, Al Mohler, in criticizing me, said, you know, Michael Dowd gives heresy a bad name. But I'm not trying to reach them so much as I'm trying to reach especially the progressive evangelicals, the moderate to liberal Christians. And I'm saying, folks, we have got to let go of this idea that the Bible is somehow more special than Shakespeare or Charles Darwin or Carl Sagan. Hmm. You know, we're going, I'm trying to call liberals, religious liberals, out of the closet. We liberal Christians do not actually go to the Bible for our sense of what's real and what's important. And yet on Sunday mornings, we go through the motions as if we do. And that's why I'm so appreciative of the New Atheist. I mean, one of the most popular sermons that I've preached in the last couple of years is called Thank God for the New Atheists. And in fact, Michael Shermer reprinted it in Skeptic, and it was reprinted also in Australasian magazine. Mm-hmm. I think it's because I'm trying to work with religious people and saying, we have got to move beyond this mythic language and fully embrace big history, the history of everyone and everything. And I think the academic discipline of big history, or what's sometimes called the epic of evolution, is some of the most exciting stuff happening, because that's where we can unite and work together to co-create a healthy future, because otherwise these mythic worldviews are going to kill us if we don't embrace evidence.
So I said that was the last question, but you just talked about these threats facing us. Maybe we were talking really about the survival of our civilization, if not our species, and that this understanding of, you used the term big history, the scientific take on our place in the universe is the way to address those challenges. You talk about big history, and it's the stuff coming out of this professor. I guess it's a movement in the academy now, but this professor, David Christian, who kind of combines disciplines in his history course that he's been teaching for a couple decades now, and it's caught on, that seems to be more than just evolution education. It's like connecting the dots between everything, and that seems to be one of your main thrusts.
Exactly. And in fact, it would be more accurate to say I'm an evangelist of big history than to say I'm an evangelist of evolution, because the evolution that I mean when I use that is the evolution of galaxies, the evolution of the universe, the evolution of everything. And back to your question not long ago, which is why don't I sort of let go of the religious language altogether? Part of it is, DJ, I'm a pragmatist. 55% of the human species, like over 3 billion people, almost 3.5 billion people, self-identify as Christians and Muslims. And most of them, or more than half of them, are on the conservative end of the spectrum. And so if we don't find ways of bringing Christianity and Islam into an evidential, science-based understanding of basically an embrace of history as our creation story, not Genesis, we're going to be in serious trouble. So that's why I'm so evangelistic about this.
I'd like to let our listeners know that if you'd like more information about Michael Dowd's work in the Christian world, you can find it at evolutionarychristianity.com. His main education website, along with his wife Connie Barlow, is thegreatstory.org. Michael Dowd, thank you so much for joining me for this fun discussion on For Good Reason.
Thank you, DJ.
Thank you for listening to this episode of For Good Reason. To get involved with an online conversation about this episode yourself, join the discussion at forgoodreason.org. Views expressed on the show aren't necessarily the views of the James Randi Educational Foundation. Questions and comments on today's show can be sent to info@forgoodreason.org. For Good Reason is produced by Thomas Donnelly and recorded from St. Louis, Missouri. For Good Reason's music is composed for us by Emmy Award-nominated Gary Stockdale. Christina Stevens contributed to today's show. I'm your host, DJ Grothy.